All right, welcome back to Ball Year Round Podcast. As always, a Sunday story. We got part two today of Chuck Frayne's basketball jack of all trades story. We got a little table talk to start, a little future Pacific Northwest Stars, and then you know, we really into his transition into reffing and all that fun stuff. You're gonna really understand the nuances of reffing and ref life a lot better after this one. So if you enjoy it, tell a friend. And be sure to subscribe and leave a review if you like the pod. And follow us on Twitter at BYRP365, also on Instagram. But yeah, here's part two of Chuck Frayne.
Focusing on my college officiating career. And the next summer, after I had stopped coaching, the same assigner, Stu, Mr. Stu Gorski, says, "Hey, I want to offer you a contract to work in the GNAC and the Cascade Conference," which is our Division II NCAA conference and our Division III conference. And I was like, "Awesome, great. Like, let's do this." And started getting serious into officiating. That's been what I've been focused on with basketball for the last 9 years now, 10 years.
That's awesome. That's, yeah, it seems you've had you were one for one with titles in college. You got two Coach of the Year awards and 3 years as coaching. You know, you got the t-shirt, you already kind of dominated the craftsman. You're ready to move on. It's kind of crazy, you know, the NCAA kind of stepping in there and, you know, instead of taking advantage of a great opportunity for some of the people, you know, that they kind of stepped in there and shut that down with the Seattle Pacific and UW situation. But when you had Tybal, you got that Australia connection with Matisse. Did you guys ever talk Australia?
You know what? We didn't. I had no clue that he was originally from Australia until I saw him on a roster this year. I had no knowledge of that. You know, it was with Matisse, he was such a humble, quiet kid. And you know, he was
still is.
Still is. And he might have been 17 years old when he was playing with, you know, God, Jamal. I mean, think about that. You got Nate Robinson, Brandon Roy, Jamal Crawford, Spencer Hawes, Martell Webster. God, I mean, the list goes on. The Portland guys, Terrence Jones and Terrence Ross coming back and playing in that league. Like, and here he is as a 17-year-old kid, just kind of bright-eyed and like, oh, this is – and he held his own. It's like I kind of let him do him. And he also went through some personal tragedies going on. His mother passed away during his senior year in high school. She had cancer, I believe. So he was kind of dealing with that while still coming and playing, and I didn't know all that. And come to find out later, it was like when he was enrolled at UW, like found out, you know, I went up and talked to him about it. He's just like, was going through a lot, and basketball was always the escape. And he actually thanked me for like inviting him to come play in that, because it was something that he, you know, could go do, because there was nothing he could do at home, which was very cool. It's like, I told him, when he came and played, said, I want to buy your jersey one day. Like, I think you're that good. And when he was getting recruited, he wasn't getting those kind of offers. Like, UW was the only big school at the time that was interested. He wasn't. Yeah. It took him 4 years of UW to really turn into what Matisse is for Philly. I mean, that kid can play.
Yeah. But
he never had the personality that put him out in the open for everyone else to kind of absorb in. He's going to have a long career.
Oh yeah. No, he's awesome. I wish he was a Celtic, to be honest. And I'm scared of him guarding the Jays for the next 10 years.
But I'm still upset. I mean, they had the pick, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they exactly.
The pick to Philly. It was the same thing when I had Isaiah, because I had Isaiah, and Isaiah was playing for Boston. And they said, "Well, we got this Isaiah." I'm like, "He's going to be an all-star." Told all my uncles, I said, "You're going to like Isaiah, grab a jersey."
Yeah. We
broke his damn hip out there playing, breaking his hip for you guys.
Yeah, he was special for a second there. Yeah, we did trade it was the 24th for the 33rd.
Yeah.
So who did we end up with in that draft?
But that kid should have been a top 15 pick. He's going to pay off like one. But because he was a four-year college kid, he's going to pay off. Defense pays in the NBA, I tell you right now. You can play like that.
Absolutely. And having those wings.
Prime example, man. Rajah Bell.
Yep.
He came out of FIU. I forgot about that, man.
Was he an FIU kid?
Yeah, with Arroyo, Carlos Arroyo. They played on the same team.
Yep. Jeez. Love it.
And who knows, like, what kind of serendipitous touch you had on Matisse Thybulle's career in terms of his growth and his confidence building and, you know, his belief in that I can hang with these dudes. Like, I'm playing pro-ams with these guys. And also, like you said, he was second banana on his high school team at the time. Like, who knows what kind of little rocket ship you put underneath him to help him get there to the next level.
You say that, but I will never, ever claim any credit to that because that kid puts in the work on his own. I was just glad to be a part of his journey, you know, and to have a little claim to say, I know that kid. He's one of the best kids I've ever seen come out of the area. You know, just solid, level-headed on his shoulders. And I wish him nothing but the best.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it was Carson Edwards is who we got for Thybulle.
Yeah. That sounds great.
Tough. Still hoping he pans out, but short guards, would have rather the defensive specialist.
Danny Ainge had a lot of wins in his career. That was not fun.
Yeah, that's kind of a sweet spot too, that like late mid draft. He found a bunch of value, but not there. Thankfully, we'll see what Brad does. But so you moved on from there and you've had a 9-year career reffing at the NCAA level. What has that kind of been like, you know, reffing in Final Fours and working with the talent?
So, junior college Final Fours, let's not confuse anybody. I am not John Higgins tossing the ball between, Kentucky and Kansas by any means. I am not that level yet. And I will tell you, reffing has been the ultimate teacher in my life. It is very humbling. And it is very cutthroat world. And you tend to learn a lot on how to deal with people in that industry all around. And officiating college basketball and high school basketball has been a very awesome journey, but it has taught me so many life lessons that has been so awesome. I can tell you, looking back on it, because we had such a shortened year last year, I can tell you of about 4 games that I reffed where I can tell you what happened in the game. Only 4. I've probably worked 1,000 games. Mm-hmm. I can tell you 1,000 stories of the road trips of the other officials that I've been with and going down to Portland, Oregon, or flying to Montana in the middle of a snowstorm, or, sitting at a rules conference with guys drinking beers. And those are the stories that, like, I love. Those are the stories I really remember. So reffing's shown a lot of life lessons. And, we talked about the got to again that Ernie Johnson talked about. I get to work games where kids are competing. I get to be a part of basketball again. And like being in that working college basketball, really, like I get to be a part of the game. And that's fun. I get to challenge myself every night to be as near perfect as I possibly can. I never will be perfect.
But it's that strive, you know, and, that's like the cool part you kind of mentioned too, was like the cutthroat of the business. And I think people really need to understand that they will replace you at any moment, as well as, you know, you have to be on top of your game every single day. I mean, like that's the expectation, especially when you're doing it for others, especially in your job, like that's the most selfless position that is on the court, but it's the most important. Otherwise the game, you know, can't go as well as the flow of the game too. Like, referees do such a great job with that and managing and players' emotions, man. It's honestly like it's like you got to be a puppeteer, man. You got to make things go. Like, it's wild. So, you know, kind of telling that story is really great. And it also opens a door for, you know, other people that are like, man, like I really want to be a part of the game, but I don't know how to stay a part of it. And I know right now officials are needed. I mean, is that true?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we are, I'd say for our high school group in the Seattle area, we are 70 to 100 officials short going into this next season. Oh, man. We normally carry about 250 to 350 officials for the high school group in the Seattle metro area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
we're about 100 short.
Man. It's a great opportunity for anybody that wants to get involved, you know, that's willing to put in the work, man. The work's there.
Yeah, and I guarantee you that's not a trend that's just in the Pacific Northwest. That's a trend that's hitting every part of the country. And you know, for me, I got into officiating to make a few extra bucks at first, and it's a nice little extra check. It's not, you know, gonna pay bills, but when I don't touch that money for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And I collect it, and all of a sudden I look in that account, and it's like, oh, hey, I can now pay for my family's vacation next month.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's where that money goes towards for me. I tend to hand the check at the end of the year for my college money. Like, I hand that to the wife and say, hey, where do you want to go this year?
That's awesome.
For the kids.
I love that. So,
when I got into officiating first, it was just for a couple bucks, and then I developed some unbelievable friendships with these guys. And you are out there on an island as an official. You are stuck with just your two partners. Mm-hmm. I always tell people there's two teams that lose every night, and I am winless in my career. Yeah. Right? There's a team that wins, there's a team that loses, and then there's the referees that they sure as hell didn't win that night.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, I've walked out of gyms where, you know, people have threatened me. And I've walked out of gyms where coaches have tried to chase me into the tunnel, or, you know, had players that wanted to, you know, accost us. And it's like, I get it. I used to be that player, you know, but we really do strive to be as perfect as we can. We don't want to be cheating anybody. Like the Tim Donaghy, former NBA cheating scandal, right? Like that, I truly believe he was a one-off, and that era of officiating has died with him. You know, we really strive to be good. I watch as much game film of me officiating as any coach watches of his own team.
Yeah.
If I work 12 Division II games, 13 Division III games, another 15 in the NAI conference, and another 20 junior college, and then you mix in another probably 20 to 30 high school games in a normal season. So we're talking about 100 games in a year that I work. I watch all of my Division II games on a deep dive, where I spend at least 3 to 4 hours on each game.
Wow.
I try to do at least one a week of my smaller conferences, where I'm doing at least one full deep dive of one game that week.
Wow.
To find out, okay, am I in the right position? Is this call correct? Is it incorrect? Like, that's the initial look. So if I get a game film, I pop it in and, you know, or download it, and I'm like, okay, so first off, am I the crew chief? Am I in the right position to start the game? How's my toss? This is a good toss just kind of sets a nice tone for the game. There's nothing worse than you toss that ball up in the air and your partner has to blow it back, or the two guys that were jumping can't get to it because you threw it too high.
Yep. So it's,
boom, check mark. That one's done. All right, what's the next step? All right. Went down this way, went down that way. Ooh, we've got a big collision. You know, guy finishes at the rim. Beautiful. All right, no call. Like, okay, I'm good with that. We go down to the other end. We've got a collision. Guy finishes it. And now we've got an and one. well, shit, that did not look as bad as the previous play. Now I'm backing up. I go look at the previous play again. Yeah, I'm still good with a no call there. We go look at the other play, and we've got this, you know, and one foul that looks exactly like the previous play. So now I'm thinking, okay. Is that motorcycle showing up in the background?
Yeah, no worries, no worries.
Like, I heard that one
coming. A little spice. Yeah, some drag racers outside.
So I look at, I go back and look at that play, and I see a no call, and I see a call on very similar plays. Well, that's not good, because now it doesn't look like we're consistent. Right? So now mm-hmm. That's what I tend to look at a lot, the consistency of the game. I might spend 30 minutes real quick going through a game and saying correct call, incorrect call, correct call, incorrect call on all my calls to me. I'm taking 20, 30 minutes maybe.
Wow.
Right? Fast forward to when I know I had calls in the game. Take a look at the play. Boom, boom, boom. Okay. Yeah, that's foul. No, I don't like that one so much. I'll clip it, put it off to the side, hold on to that, maybe send it to somebody for their opinion. But I'll spend 3 hours comparing how the game flow looks. Does this call match that call? Am I constantly, when I'm the center official, am I always getting to the 15-foot mark, you know, right up at the free throw line extended? Hey, when this guy dribbles in front of me and he moves to the left, do I move right so I get an open angle? Those are the things that I constantly am looking at.
Wow.
I want to be in the best position possible on every play so that I have the best opportunity to be correct on every play.
Yeah, I never really think of that. Like, your anticipation of your positioning probably is like half of the nuance, because you got to be able to see it to be able to call it right, kind of thing. Did you watch film much before becoming a ref, or was this when you picked up the old film habit?
That's when I picked up the film habit. I went to a training academy called the Emerald City Officials Academy, and it was ran by a guy named Mark Cook and a guy named Greg Nixon, who were both Pac-12 referees. Greg Nixon's worked multiple Elite Eights. So we're talking top 50 official in the country at the Division I level, easily, if not top 20. And they just hammered on film. And they hammered on the science of officiating. Of, if you are always in the right position, your call accuracy skyrockets. And then you think about that with everything else in life. Am I constantly putting myself in the best position at my job? Am I always showing up on time? Am I always, like, for me, being an electrician, knowing I have preventive maintenance things to deal with, okay, am I constantly checking, you know, my electrical connections, like, once a year? Okay, that's something I should do. I want to make sure that my building doesn't break down. I'm going to go make sure that the generator is wired up properly or that the connections are solid. No one's touched the generator in 25 years since the building was built. But can connections go bad over 25 years? Sure, let's go check that. I'm going to put myself in a position to be successful. So I like doing that at work, and I kind of took that from officiating. It's silly, right? Think about it. But 3 years ago, I went to go check the generator, and the B phase on the generator, which is 480 volts, is loose. Well, if the generator would have kicked on because we had an emergency, we would have lost a phase of the building. We would not have emergency power. Oh, that phase happens to control the emergency power for the elevators. I have a 58-story building. We can't get people off the 58th floor.
Wow.
That applies.
That's funny. Yeah. I mean, you always think about, like, me and Andy always talk about, like, how much basketball, you know, and the ethos of basketball, and that, you know, whether it's the confidence or learning something new or the Kaizen incremental improvements, how much that applies to regular life. Never really thought of it applying to electrician's life, but that's pretty awesome.
I never thought I would either. And I kind of took that, you know, that thing about always being in the right position. And I don't have to blow my whistle on every call.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm in the right position, my call accuracy goes up. The NBA did a study. And so I met a guy named Billy Kennedy. longtime NBA official, right? Mm-hmm. Just 55 years old, jacked. I mean, nicest guy in the world. Awesome karaoke singer. If you ever get a chance to see him in a bar, greatest karaoke. He loves doing any kind of Frank Sinatra. That's his jam. side stories. But he told me that he brought the study presentation to us at a training academy that I was at. And the NBA did a study that for NBA officials only, when they blew their whistle and they were out of position, their call accuracy dropped 25%. When they were in the right position and they blew their whistle, their accuracy was at 95%.
Wow.
So they were. So you're never going to be perfect as an official. You're going to get plays wrong. You anticipate, whatever. So there's always that 5%. The NBA guys are 95% accurate. Division One guys are about 90 to anywhere between 92 and 95. Division Two guys are in the 87 to 92 range. Your high school official is about 75% of the time.
Oh.
Be fair. That's where we're at.
That's impressive, though.
You know, like they did that study on that. That if you are in the right position and you blow your whistle, you're going to be right 95% of the time.
That's a ridiculous expectation to put on yourself too. To get to that level is a level of perfectionism that is enviable for sure. Yeah. But I feel like a lot of the times that we'll get frustrated at a ref, it feels like it's the ref that's not necessarily closest to the action. Like maybe the under the basket ref makes a call on something on the perimeter. Do you find like that is a commonality kind of in your experience too, or is that just my fallacy observation as a fan?
What's that, coach?
Out of area call.
Right.
I've heard that before.
Yep. And that's one of those things where it's positioning and what is your responsibility? And mm-hmm. that part did fall into the study as well. If you call out of area, out of position, that's where your 20% drop off is.
Hmm.
So, if you end up reaching, we call it ball watching in our world a lot. Okay. If you've got an official who's constantly, his head is moving wherever the basketball goes. When I train new officials and I start seeing that, uh-huh. and I pull them to the side and say, hey, what kind of basketball are we using today? You're like, oh, I don't know. I didn't look. So we've been watching it for the last 20 plays. Right? It's like, our job is to referee the defense. The defense is who does something illegal 90% of the time in the game, right? So our job, we watch the defense. We watch how the defense reacts. If the defense moves forward into the offense, the defense has committed the foul. If the defense gets legal position and the offense creates the contact, it's either a no call or the offense is offensive players call for the foul, right? So if we always watch the defense, we can determine whether they do something illegal or legal. That's how we officiate. That's why if you want to know why the NBA is so bad with traveling, the first reason why they're so bad at traveling is because their rules and the way they're written are horrible.
Yep.
The second one is we do not watch the offensive player as much as people do.
Wow.
The common fan is going to watch the offensive player. We are watching the defensive player.
Gotcha.
Especially when you get to that level, you assume guys know how to dribble a basketball and you assume they know how to pivot. So you out of habit, you're like, I don't need to watch Kevin Durant's pivot foot. I don't need to watch. Well, I think we learned we need to watch James Harden's pivot foot.
Yes. Heck yeah. Wow. That's actually that's some really good insight. Honestly, I never thought of it that way, You're watching the game, even as a coach. I mean, you're not necessarily watching every play necessarily, but you're watching what the offense is doing. And you're watching what their defense is doing. You're kind of watching it all. But you can definitely, as a coach, sometimes you're calling travel. Yeah, man, it's a travel. But I get it now. Like that makes sense. You're focused on something. You're worried about that defense.
When we talk about calls out of our area, from a coach's standpoint. So I think that's, you see a referee call something that from 30 feet away,
yeah.
Like you'll see it. It's usually a delayed whistle. So the foul happens. The guy closest to it couldn't see it or doesn't call. And then all of a sudden the guy from 35, 40 feet away decides, oh, that's a fucking foul.
Yeah.
Right. And so he's coming in and it's like, I always tell people, and for me, it's you just bet your first round of drinks after the game on whether you're correct on that call or not.
Yeah.
Like I always tell guys that if I come fishing in your pond, I'm coming for sharks and whales. I'm not coming for minnows.
Yeah.
So when we go out and work, if something happens in front of you, I'm going to trust that you have judged that to be legal or illegal. I have to trust my partners. I don't have as much information as my partner because I'm responsible for a different third of the court at any given time. So if something catches my eye and it's crazy looking and you don't have a whistle and I decide I have to come get it, it better be a shark. And if it's not a shark or not a whale, and I've come over and gotten something that just tears up the gym and I'm completely wrong, I'm the first one to, throw my card down and I'm buying drinks for the night for the crew. When we go meet up after the game or we're driving home, it's like, and it's dinner time, I'm the one that's now, like, that's the way a lot of us operate. It's like, that's my fault. We take a lot of pride as officials on being accurate and working as a crew and not big timing each other.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like officials that come in and because you've big timed, you've worked a Division I game and now you're down here working this Division II game, that you're a big dog. Like, no. Where, who's our Loyola Marymount coach again?
Stan Johnson.
Coach Stan Johnson. He said it during his, and it was one of my favorite things he said. The big time isn't where you're going to get to. It's where you're at, right? So we talk about referee, the big time game is the game that you have that night. I can tell you about games where I worked, O'Day versus Rainier Beach. It was Kevin Porter Jr. against Kala Banchero. It's like, yeah, it's awesome. I got to work a state championship game.
Wow.
Well, I don't remember. I remember two plays from the state championship game that I got to work. I remember 30 plays from working with my best friend on a junior college game on a Wednesday night in January where – we were busting each other's balls the entire game and we had a 3.5 hour drive home in the snow. Like I remember that way more than I remember how I refereed my state championship game. Like that's enjoyment.
So cool.
Yeah. And so the big time is whatever game you are working on. And I can compare notes with just about 95% of officials and say, oh yeah, I worked this game. I worked that game. I got to toss the ball. And I've worked on an ESPN game or whatever. Cool. Mm-hmm. Were you good with your partners? Did you go buy beers afterwards or, get a bite? Did you guys carpool? Yep. Like, did you drive through a flood and get stuck in it? Like, tell me some shit you've been in. Like,
I think that's super underrated. I never really even thought about how much camaraderie and kind of like trust building is necessary for a good refereeing crew. And, you were saying obviously the NBA guys are at the height of the profession thing. Situations like, for example, Tony Brothers' crew, which somehow Tony Brothers murders our Celtics sometimes too, but how does a guy like Chris Paul end up with an 0-12 record on Tony Brothers' kind of cruise? Like, that's just kind of like happenstance, or do they have like a little headbutt situation of the past?
So I think it's Scott Foster that he's 0-12 with.
Was it Foster, not Tony? Okay.
And I can't speak for Scott Foster. I've heard him speak twice, and he's extremely knowledgeable, and to be honest, he's probably one of the most accurate play callers in the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
He's also the most hated official by NBA players. He gets voted as the least liked official every year, and I don't think that's good, right? Mm-hmm. I like to build camaraderie and relationships. I've got a history of being a player, working as a coach at different levels, and I've developed a relationship that with a lot of coaches in my area, where this is what has benefited me to make games go smooth. I can talk to a coach and calm them, walk them off a cliff. I can talk to a player really easily. I think NBA players are very, very difficult to talk to. I think there's a lot of ego and testosterone and uncertainty and maybe a lot of insecurity for a lot of those guys. Mm-hmm. And so I will tell you that almost every NBA ref I've met has, they seem like they have a psychology degree and know how to talk to people. So I will pick Scott Foster's side in the fact that it is not intentional that Chris Paul has a 0-16 record when Scott is on the court. But, you know, it's unfair, I think, that Scott gets thrown in the media with stats like that.
Yeah. It's an easy target, kind of clickbait thing. Obviously, Tim Donaghy relationship of the past kind of thing has been talked about. And I always find it interesting. I mean, everyone's kind of talked about this too, the pocket of New Jersey where 90% of NBA refs kind of come from. And Scott Foster's obviously kind of the old elder statesman of that area in that group.
Yeah. And they're all disciples off of Ed Rush, who was a longtime official. And it was funny because when I first got into officiating, Ed Rush was the Pac-12 assignment. And he got fired because he had said something inappropriate in the locker room to his officials. And he had said something wrong. And he said it in jest, was my understanding. The interpretation was, what do you guys need to do your job? Do you need a bonus? Do you need a trip to Cancun? Somebody needs to do their job. In reference to a Pac-12 coach who was acting a fool on the sidelines and should have gotten a technical foul. And so Ed Rush has a meeting with all of his officials, and he says something like that. One of the officials leaks that information out. It comes across as Ed Rush giving incentive to get technical fouls, which is not appropriate. But I think the whole story got twisted wrong, in my opinion, from what I've heard. Ed Rush is an unbelievable referee. He comes from an old school standpoint. Of how to manage a game, how to talk to coaches, how to talk to players. He tells a great story of he would go up to Michael Jordan, you know, and he was on a first name basis with Michael because the guy had been reffing since 1966, right? So he worked every big game. He worked every NBA Finals game throughout the 80s and 90s. So he goes up to Michael Jordan and says, "Hey, Michael, how bad do you need Dennis tonight?" 20 minutes into the game, talking about Dennis Rodman.
Yeah.
And Michael would be honest with him. Not that bad. Come on, Ed, let me talk to him. You know, those are the two answers that he would give. Ed, I'll talk to him, or not that bad. And then Ed Rush knew whether he could toss Dennis at the next time he did something stupid or whether Michael was going to go talk to Dennis.
Wow. That's
real. It's like, how awesome is a story is that, right?
No, that's like real feel of the game, you know, like taking the time to get to know players, know tendencies, kind of see like, you know, when somebody might do something, let me talk to the leader real quick, but having the trust, you know, to be able to do that, you know, that's real game management.
And that becomes kind of a standard in how a lot of us officiate now. I go up to a coach, and Coach Andy, you can tell me how you feel about this. If I come up to you and say, hey, 12 might need a sub. What's your decision?
You know, honestly, in my opinion, like I've never had anybody come up and tell me that.
Yeah.
In the moment, I'll be like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, at the same time, sometimes I will see, like, for example, if you have a guy like, you know, I was watching the Malice in the Palace today, you know, like you see some looks in Ron Artest's eyes. It's like, all right, man, it's time to get Ron, you know, like, you know, so there's, I appreciate that, you know, as a coach, you know, as you build that relationship with the ref, I want to hear that kind of stuff. Definitely.
And I won't do it to a coach unless I know I have the clout in that league or with that coach to be able to say something like that. If I'm a rookie in that league, I'm not saying a word to the coach ever. Like I need to build my reputation. I need to build that trust. Yeah. But I go into, I mean, almost every conference I work in now, I can go to a coach and say, if I say, hey, 12 needs a sub, or you might want to think about getting 12, it's me telling you he has used up all his rope with me, and the next thing he says, we're going to attack.
Yeah.
So I'm giving you an opportunity. Some coaches don't like it. I've had coaches blow me off, and the next time the kid says something, I'm like, all right, you earned it. You might not have earned it on that statement. You might have earned it on the statement before,
yeah,
to be honest with you. But, like, that one's the cherry. Yeah. That makes sense, you know? So I like to try and work with kids, too. Like, because I coached, it was like, try to relate. Hey, I get what you're trying to do. I'm not mad at you. I'm not mad at you. Just because I blew my whistle does not mean I'm mad at you, bro. Yeah. Let's work. Like, you trust me, and we'll get through this. One of my favorite lines, and I always tell officials, you can use it once in a game, and you better be honest when you use it, and you better not have to use it again. And I'll tell kids that, you know, when I'm reffing and I'm tough foul, I was dead wrong. Not my favorite whistle of the night, boss. I might have missed that one. I might be wrong.
Yeah.
Not perfect. Yeah.
That's that kind of like give and take, like you're saying too. It's like, you know, I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. Like, I'll give you a break, you give me a break if, you know, yeah, tensions are getting tight. And, you know, you don't want to throw somebody out the game. You don't want to shift the tide with free throws and a possession of a technical, you know.
Yeah. You can't, and you can't use it in the first 2 minutes, and you can't lose it, use that last.
That's a good rule of thumb for that one, too. That's a mid third quarter.
If I go to a coach in the first 2 minutes and say, I might have missed that one. Well, 2 minutes later, there's another tough call. You miss that one, you miss that one, you miss that one, and you're probably going to miss the next one is what his response is going to be, right? I do it in the last 2 minutes, I've cost them the game.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But there's that spot in the middle, that middle 36 is what I tell guys. You know, not the first, you know, the last 40 minutes in the game, right? The middle 36 where we can massage things out and, you know, I've always been a believer as a coach and as a player that you're not going to get every call you're in your favor, right? Mm-hmm. So referees aren't going to cost you a game. They can cost you a game the last minute, right? Last two. There can be a big call, tough call. I do believe that there's that possibility. I mean, but I also missed a shot in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
What everyone remembers is that last call, last mm-hmm. minute. If you blow one that's not there, that changes a tide in a close game. I can kind of buy into the fact that a referee can screw up the ending of the game. So, but that middle 36, we can massage it to where coaches and players believe what we're doing and we're doing the best that we can, and we can take ownership over everything. The last 2 minutes, we have to be perfect. Mm-hmm. Crunch time, we have to be perfect.
Wow.
Everyone remembers your last whistle.
Yeah,
so when we go in for the last 2 minutes, coach takes a timeout in the last minute, my crew's getting together. Hey guys, let's not change anything we've done tonight. All of our plays to the basket, we've let contact go. Let's be consistent right now. Do not call anything we haven't called the last, you know, these last 2 minutes. We didn't call it the first 36, we're not calling the last four. Right? If you know, we know what's happening, you know, we get together. 30 seconds left on the clock, guys. It's black ball. They can run the end line, right? They've got two timeouts each. Are we looking for a three-point shot? Are we looking for a two? Are they trying to foul right away? You know, those kinds of things. Those are the conversations that you're having with your partners and your crew in those situations.
I got a real quick question. How about those times with, like, you know, 3 seconds left, teams got it. The other team scored so they can run the baseline. And I was just watching this with Syracuse and what they did with Johnny Flynn. And they had him, you know, be the point guard and then step in front of the guy who's running the inbound. And then that inbound defender runs that guy over.
Setting the screen on the inbound defender?
Yeah, but like he tried to take a charge on it, you know, like, and just have that inbound defender who's guarding the ball as he's running the baseline take that charge. Is that ever a call like that is actually made, or is it kind of a play on type of deal?
So there is verbiage in the rule book that says that not all contact is illegal contact. Mm-hmm. And there are times where contact that is severe can be unpenalized. So screens are those kinds of plays. Big body contacts where we have good verticality, where the defender goes straight up. So in that sense, you've got a guy running the end line, right? Offensive player trying to semi-truck gun. So you got a guy running the end line trying to inbound, correct? Yep. You got a defender guarding him.
Yep.
And then you got someone trying to set a screen on that defender, basically, taking a charge. Yeah,
take a charge. Right? Yeah.
So he's trying to set a screen on that defender while to open up the guy throwing it in.
Yep.
So you can have a very severe contact on a screener and not have a call.
Wow.
Now we start to look at intent of the player. If that player defending the inbounder, he sees that screen and decides to blow it up, now we have a foul.
Wow.
That's if that's a blind screen and he doesn't know it's there, we have to determine that how severe is the contact and is it worthy of being penalized. Uh-huh. Did Johnny Flynn have a foot on the out-of-bounds line? He's now illegal player on the playing court. You can't take a charge when your foot's on the end line, right?
Oh, I did not know.
Got to have both feet on the court.
Cut off that end line or cut off that baseline.
Right. We teach it, right? As coaches, hey, get your foot on the end line.
Oh, wow.
Well, good. You want to stop them. But if you try to take a charge with your foot on the end line, it's technically a block by rule.
Wow.
That's the stuff that blew my mind when I started reading the rule book. I'm like, oh, my God, I thought I knew basketball.
Wow.
I don't even call it the baseline anymore. The rule book calls it the end line. It's the end line. It's not the half court line. It's the division line. It's like my verbiage is completely messed up. So I look at plays like that, and I mean, God, this is the stuff that we do as officials. My crew, I've got a group of about 12 guys, and we meet. We start meeting in September, and we meet once a week all the way up until about the first week in November, and we go over two rules a night. There's 11 rules in the rule book.
Oh, wow.
And so, first one, we go over some questions about the court and any rules changes. The backboard change. Did the rules about freaking jerseys change? Is name, image, likeness going to ruin me? I don't know. But, we go over these things for 5-6 weeks. We cover two rules a night, and we send in plays, and we talk about plays that apply to those rules, and we look at how can we officiate this better. How can we manage a coach better? We look at these things to get ready for the season, because as a coach, how long have you been practicing before your first game?
At least 2 months. At least.
Right? How many practice games do I get before my first game? How can I go referee a basketball game before your first game of the season?
It's impossible unless you're like lucky as heck and can do some other games or whatever. But
right. My best opportunity is I get to go do some scrimmages at a college, maybe. Like UW calls us up and says, hey, we need some referees because we want a scrimmage tonight. Exactly. And then we go to a 3-hour practice and we might get a 20-minute scrimmage if we're lucky.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's how we prepare. We got to get ourselves in game shape for 2 months before we go referee a game. 2 years ago, this is one of those games I remember. It's my second year working Division II college ball. And I get my schedule. I'm starting to fill out my calendar. I get my schedule in usually like mid-October from most of my assigners for college. So I can kind of start filling out, okay, I'm working Thursday at Western Washington, which is a 2-hour drive away. Friday, I've got a Division III game down in Olympia, which is 2 hours south of me. And then Saturday, I've got a junior college game, which is a home game. So I'm like, that's a short commute. Okay, cool. There's my schedule. What time am I leaving work? All that stuff. Do I need a hotel room that night? Like, I've got to schedule all that stuff out. So I get my schedule, and I'm like, my schedule's set. Okay, cool. My first game's like November 22nd. I've got two junior college scrimmages before that game. So I've got some time to get into my game shape. All of a sudden, get an email. You have a new game. Oh, okay. What is this? Oh, I've got a Division II game on November 9th. And it's Cal State, California Poly Pomona, which is a Division II school that went to the Elite Eight for the NCAA Division IIs at SPU. I have nothing on my calendar going into this game. And both teams were in the Sweet 16 the year prior.
Wow.
How am I supposed to referee basically two teams that are favorites to go to the regionals and go to the national tournament? How am I supposed to be in game shape for that?
Yeah.
Coaches expect the best out of us, right? You expect perfection from your officials. You want a fair, I mean, maybe not perfection, but you expect us to be in game shape.
Yep. Yeah. Got to get over that half court line, man. Got to get to that.
Yep.
Man, got to get there, man.
Like, yeah, I can't, you know, plays and you know, I can run all summer. I can hop on the Peloton and get my, you know, 3,000 miles in between now and November. But if I'm not seeing plays and seeing athletes be athletes, you know, how much trouble am I going to be in?
That's tough, man.
Yeah.
And it's like going to the free throw line cold, like with the game on the line, like for a whole game of that kind of mental pressure and like, you know.
And I end up, you know, we end up refereeing a really good game that night. It ends up being a 2-point game. And I remember the call because it's probably one of the toughest calls I've had in my entire career. It's one of those few calls that I remember. And it's a block charge play against SPU, Seattle Pacific University, in front of their bench. And it's like, so that's the team that I have to see on a regular basis. I don't go see Cal Poly Pomona on a regular basis. I see Seattle Pacific.
Yeah.
And here I am making a tough call at a 2-point game with 30 seconds left or whatever, calling a charge against his guy and shipping it. You know, you're like, did I fist went up. I went, sold that thing like a champion. I look good on film doing it. You know. Yeah.
Was it a block or a charge?
You know what? He was outside the RA, so I consider it still a charge. It's close. I wish I had another camera angle.
Yeah.
It was close. I mean, it was a tough play. The guy's kind of sliding at the end. I think he gets both feet down. He's definitely outside the restricted arc, but it's like it was a tough play. And I'm like, I've sent out all my Division I guys, and – it's come back split 50-50.
And how did Seattle Pacific react to it?
So I you know, this comes from having a relationships with coaches from my previous days before I was an official. The head coach is a guy named Grant Leap, who was an assistant coach when I was playing at Lower Columbia College. So I had a previous relationship with him. He went on to be an assistant at Eastern Washington University, where a point guard of mine that I knew went, and like we just had this intertwining of relationship over 15 years of basketball. So he jumped up and down. He lost his mind for a second. You know, I asked my crew chief, because I wasn't the lead official on the game, which doesn't really ever matter, but you know, I asked him, I said, do we want to go look at the monitor? And he just said, nope, he's out of the RA, we're good. And Grant, you know, ran over and he looked at the monitor, and the monitor had like the live stream, so they were all of a sudden showing the replay on the monitor. So he looked and he saw he was out of the RA, and so he just kind of moved on. And so I got lucky.
Hmm. So you mentioned, you know, a few times the occasional player or coach got a little upset with you maybe in your 9 years. Any sort of like specific one that sticks out? Any sort of, you know, Bobby Knight chucking a chair kind of thing? Or,
you know, in junior college, we come across these players on occasion. We talk about the NWAC, which is the Northwest Athletic Conference. Well, officials, when we talk about giving somebody a tech, we say we whack them, right? So this is the, you know, one tech is a whack. Well, we work in the NWAC, and it lives up to its reputation, lives up to its name. This last year, coming out of COVID, one of my first games. I've got a Everett Community College, and I'll leave coaches' names out of this one, at Whatcom Community College. And I've got a rookie referee who I'm helping a lot, great guy. He's getting an earful from one of the coaches, and that coach is complaining about the other coach towing the sideline and kind of making the sideline tighter.
Yeah.
Right. He's an added defender. He's talking about that coach. Well, all of a sudden that coach, and he's sitting there listening to this coach, and he's supposed to be administering the inbound. And I'm sitting there 85 feet away, like, put the ball in play. Like, this was running through my head. I'm like, this is not going to go well. Put the ball in play. He can keep talking. Just put the ball in play so that everyone gets focused on basketball. Well, he doesn't. He's sitting there holding the ball, smiling, nodding, like, okay, I hear you, coach. Well, the other coach hears the fact that this coach is talking about him. So he's yelling at that coach. Oh, this isn't going to go good.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, both coaches are yelling at each other. And they meet at center court, nose to nose, cussing at each other. And my partner, the rookie, who – at this point, he'd only worked high school basketball. He hadn't worked any college ball. This is like his first college game. He has no idea what to do. So I have to come running all the way up from the end line and get in between both coaches and separate them. And one coach, his two assistants were there helping, trying to pull their coach back. The other assistant's sitting on the bench still, like, I don't know what to do. So I end up giving a double tech to the coaches for unsporting technical fouls. And it's just the weirdest thing. I'm like, I never thought I would give a double tech to the two coaches and have them nose to nose, just like going at each other. It's very
interesting.
Yeah. And those are the kinds of things that only happen in junior colleges.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen at the NCAA level. It doesn't happen where, you know, that happens where coaches get paid very minimal.
Yeah, not a huge check or fine on the line.
Yeah. You know, you're like, yeah, if you lose that job, it's probably not your main income. Where, you know, NCAA Division II, Division I, Division III coaches are all getting paid. Like, that's where their career and money is. Mm. And I never realized that when I first got into officiating. We had a Division III coach come out and talk. He's like, no, this is what I do for a living. Division II coaches get paid to coach for a living. I mean, they might run a PE program, but that PE program, that title comes with that coaching job. Yeah. You don't have that coaching job, you no longer run that administration of the athletic department or whatever it may be, right? I didn't realize that. So my calls and how good of an officiating crew we can be, like, if we have a good night and we're good, it's not on us. But if you all of a sudden have two Division II schools that are battling for a playoff spot, one coach hasn't made the playoffs in 3 years, and you have a bad game. Like, we have bad games, but we want to be good. I might cost the coach a job. I might cost myself an assignment. I lose $500. I cost the coach a job. He's got to move his wife and kids to the next school that he gets hired at. It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
It's different.
Yeah, that's
when you're coaching for money, man. It's way different.
I mean,
every minute is focused on it, man. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, like the coach had said before you guys interviewed, he don't coach for money, right? You don't want to do that, but it's still their livelihood. And my job as an official, I don't want to impact anybody's livelihood. I don't want to impact a game. I just want to be right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's similar to a kid we had on as well. Ted Bancroft had that realization as a player at, you know, Division I level, like, oh, if I screw up, like, my coach could get fired. I'm still going to be here at school, but
his scholarship's still good. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. Like, yeah. And then there's the rat race of it all.
The rat race of it all, yeah. The travel, you got some good miles, or you're not flying too much, are you?
Not too much. So we are one of the few Division II conferences that fly quite a bit, because the GNAC Great Northwest Athletic Conference. We cover schools in Seattle and in Washington State, Oregon State, Idaho, Montana, but we also have both the Alaska schools, University of Alaska Fairbanks, University of Alaska Anchorage, where if you guys love college basketball as much as everyone else does, the Great Alaska Shootout Tournament that always happened at the beginning of the year, hosted at University of Alaska Anchorage. Wow. Division II school. That's, you know, Duke went up there and Gonzaga's gone up there. They did it for the first day. They canceled it 2 years ago, and then last year they had it up there. And they hosted, I forget who played in that, but you know, the Maui Invitational has kind of ruined the Great Alaska Shootout.
Yeah.
I don't blame anybody. I'd rather go to Maui than go to Alaska in November, personally.
For sure.
But I don't blame. I love the Maui.
So our conference will send us up to Alaska or fly us to Boise. For me, flying out of Seattle, I'll fly to Boise. It's a 7.5-hour drive, so they'll fly us for that. Montana State, Billings, we'll fly to. But most of our Seattle I-5 corridor will have to drive. And I think the longest drive is about 6 hours.
Wow.
So my typical week, get me into January, non-COVID year, Tuesday night, I'll probably work a high school game. Somewhere local, 20 minutes away from my house. And because of where I've worked hard, it's probably going to end up being in the Metro League, which is where all of our top dogs have come out of. Nate Robinson, Brandon Roy, is like the Metro League in Seattle is just ridiculously good. It's unbelievable. So it'll be that. Then Wednesday night will be a junior college night. So I'll work, you know, hopefully Everett or Bellevue or a South Seattle school is maybe within an hour drive. So I leave work at 3:30, 4 o'clock, pretty much go straight to the gym. It could be anywhere within an hour drive of Seattle if I'm lucky with traffic.
Yeah.
You know, we have to be at the gym at least an hour before tip-off. Tip-off's at 7. There's no reason for me to go home. Mm-hmm. Take your gear, get there. Usually for me, because I work in a sweaty industry, I take a shower when I get there, and then I do my hair and shave. I'm always clean shaven. We're always clean shaven for our games. You know, go out, work a 7:30 tip off, get out of the gym, hopefully by 9:30, 10 o'clock, have at least an hour and a half drive home, maybe on a close night. That's Wednesday. Wake up at 6 a.m. the next morning, go to work. During my lunch break, I tend to break down film on Thursday for my Wednesday night game. Thursday, I've got a GNAC game. Oh, shoot, you're going up to Simon Fraser University, which is up in Vancouver, B.C. So I'm leaving work early. I'm taking an hour off, you know, taking vacation time, driving up to Canada, got to get through the border. Then you got to get to Simon Fraser, which, God forbid, you use your GPS on your phone in Canada and get roaming charges, you know. And finding the gym on that campus is insane. So I get up there, find the gym, get there. Got to show up an hour and a half for your Division II games. I got to be up there at 6 for a 7:30 tip-off. I got to get through Seattle and Boeing Everett traffic.
Yeah.
You know, then I come home and I'm like, oh, look, I've got a Friday, Saturday night in Portland. So I go to work at 5 a.m. on Friday because I can't take too much time off of work and waste all my vacation time. Got to be on the road to Portland no later than 1 p.m. if you want to be in Portland on time. Mm-hmm. I've got to Portland. Get a hotel down there at the Red Lion or, you know, wherever. Friday night, go work your Division III game down there. Luckily, you get a double dip, so you get 2 games down there on a Friday-Saturday swing. They pay your travel fee for both games. Then Sunday, you get to come home, and you take Monday off and rest.
Heck yeah.
Wow.
That's a week. That's a random week.
Grind.
Yeah, and not to mention if you're like me and you enjoy adult beverages – and you go down to Portland with a couple of guys, you all end up going out for drinks on Saturday night.
That's awesome. That's too funny. Yeah, that is. I think that's a grind that definitely goes underappreciated. I think a lot of people kind of assume like, oh, the refs like are they bring in the most local crew per se. But I mean, at that level, at Division II and Division I and NBA, obviously, like, you know, these are professionals that are being flown in just like the opposing team, like, for the most part. That's crazy.
No, and it's, you know, it's the grind is awesome when you have guys that you like to be around. Yes. And you learn to really appreciate and build your brotherhood. And, you know, what's really awesome about it all is the journey of climbing the ladder of, like, at first I just wanted to work high school basketball for a little side job, a little extra cash. Then someone came in and kind of showed me the carrot of Division I money. And those guys at Division I level, you know, if you work, if you're working the NCAA tournament, you're making good money. Like, we're talking quit your day job. That's your job for life or for the year. Like, that's what you do, right? It's enough to pay your bills. NBA guys, ridiculous. Like, if you're an NBA playoff guy, you're making good enough money to where you've got a house in Arizona and a house in Seattle or a house in Boston or whatever. Like, you've got two homes. You're one of those people. So people dangled that carrot in front of me, and I was like, oh, that's what I want to do. And there was a time where I was coming up, and I climbed the ladder really quick. Went to high school. Okay, all of a sudden, boom, you're a varsity official after 1 year. Boom, after 1 year of varsity, I got hired to work junior college. 2 years later, you know, I quit coaching. I quit doing the summer league, and immediately after I quit coaching the summer league, boom, I got hired in Division II and Division III. It's like, wow, I'm good. I must be good at this. I'm going to be tossing the ball in the Final Four. You know, they're going to play one shining moment, and this is going to be me tossing the ball in the air at the opening credit, right? Like, that's what I wanted. That was a dream, right? Well, then it kind of stopped. Like, that, like, now I've been working Division II college ball for 5 years, and I haven't worked Division II playoff game. I haven't gotten the Division III regional. I haven't been invited to the Pac-12 consortium tryout camp yet. You know, all the Western conferences for Division I haven't called me and said, hey, we want you to come try out to be in the Big Sky and work Division I. Like, I'm not getting any sniffs. And I had a bad attitude, like, really quick. And I had a mentor of mine that I bounce a lot of things off of, and he's kind of told me, you know, if you're not having fun and you're not enjoying this, like, don't chase that carrot, because that carrot may never show up. And it's really political. The world of officiating has a lot of reasons why. It might be because I don't fit a mold. It might be because my officiating is not that good. Whatever the reason is, somebody has a reason for me not being there. And then I thought about it. Why am I doing it? I got in for just a few extra dollars, and someone dangled a carrot. Okay, why am I chasing the carrot? Do I need the carrot? No, I don't need the carrot. I've got a good job. So why am I doing this? Something one of the coaches said was, don't compare yourself. I've got a buddy that's all of a sudden working he's working in the NBA Summer League right now. I started before him. Why am I not working summer league? Well, that's not the right attitude. What he does is different than what I do. It's not about the destination. It's about your path.
Absolutely.
Okay. My journey is going to be different than his. So I stopped remembering all the good games and bad games I had, or remembering other officials' good calls and bad calls. And I started having a lot more fun. And then I got a lot better. Exactly. So I stopped caring about everybody else's journey and focused on my own. And in a sense, I mean, I wouldn't say I stopped caring about everybody else's journey. I started caring about other people's journeys and being a part of their journey. Not that I was competing against. Yeah. I've always compared officiating to the game of golf. I can't beat Tiger Woods or, you know, worry about beating my buddy that I'm playing with. Like, I have to play my own game. I can't drive the ball 300 yards. I can put a 250 down the middle. Okay, let's play from 250. Mm-hmm. If he wants to hit a 300, he can hit a 300 down the middle. I can't stop that. That's not my journey. So what am I going to do? And so I started focusing on that. And then I started giving back. I started helping other officials. I became the apprentice chair for my local high school chapter and running the apprentices for a couple of years. And decided, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to help somebody get there. I want to help somebody have fun in this world. We talked about the shortage of officials in a lot of cities. Across the country, we have a huge shortage of officials. They're underpaid, they're underappreciated, and, you know, I just think today's society does not like confrontation.
At all.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know what to do.
Don't know. So I want to help fix that problem. I want to try and help us get better officials. I want to help fans and coaches and players all appreciate officials a little bit more too. Mm-hmm. You know? Yep. So that's kind of what my focus has been on the last 2 years. And so I've got a good rules group. I got a couple of really good mentors that have helped me find my path and let me, you know, continue my journey the way it needs to go. And I've really enjoyed that.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, comparison can kind of be like the thief of joy kind of thing. And it sounds like, you know, once you stopped comparing, it became a lot more joyful. And also, like, you're at a very, very high level. And like me and Andy talk about all the time, like, you know, there's the 0.1% of, you know, basketball players that make it to like the Division I level. And then some of the guys get there and they're like, you know, they're not the best player anymore necessarily. Not that you're not the best ref, but the, you know, like, it's such an elite level. The margin of error is like, you know, tiny, like, you know, and it can be a connections-based world in some ways. And the good news is, though, you know, you can ref as long as you really want to. So it's not like that that door is necessarily shut anytime soon. That's for sure.
No, and for me, I don't know if I'll ever quit officiating like that. You know, Andy can relate to this right now with the age of his kids. The amount of time that we commit to basketball starts taking away from family time. And I've had to make a few sacrifices as far as, you know, when I'm, you know, gone for 3 days away from my kids because I wanted to go, you know, to a referee training academy, or I have two games down in Portland and then the, you know, like I'm leaving straight from work. So I got to make sure I kiss my girls goodbye. So I had a lot of troubles with my relationship with my wife when we had our first kid. I'll be honest. The divorce papers were almost getting like printed up. That's where it was. And I had to reassess exactly what was going on in our relationship and be like, hey, I need to make a better commitment. And that's one thing I love about officiating. When you strive to be good in one world of your life, it tends to affect the other side. And if you realize that when you're striving too much to be good in one thing and your focus goes there, you're not getting that much better if you're not balancing out your life. And so it took me balancing out my life, talking to my wife a little bit more, making sure I made a commitment to coming home on when I can get home, not like, hey, I'll pick up a hotel, or hey, I'm going to go have beers with the boys after the game, or whatever, you know, might be the cause. It's, or hey, my kid goes to bed at 7:30. If I have the opportunity to be home before 7:30, I better be home at 7:30. Yeah. That's not stopping for a beer on the way home, or stopping to go see, you know, a friend you hadn't seen in a while. Or, you know, when I get home, am I turning my phone off for 2 hours so that my kids get all my attention, right? So then after they go to bed, I can hop on a podcast and talk about my passion, right? Or after they go to bed, I can break down game film. Like, that's actually affected more of my basketball watching than anything. Is the fact that I've chosen to watch my game film versus enjoying watching basketball. It sucks. I do miss watching basketball. And, but, I mean, that's kind of, you have to pick and choose, right? And if you balance your life out right, you end up being more successful in places. So I had to reassess exactly how I treated my wife and my kids. Made sure that when I make sure I Zoom call my kid or FaceTime if I know I'm not going to be home that night. Mm-hmm. I always talk about whatever's going on for the day. Hey, how was your day? Did you know, are you being a good girl for mommy? What are you having for dinner? Spend at least 20 minutes talking to my kid, right? And then I get that out of the way. Like, I mean, I don't mean to say get it out of the way like it's a checklist and it's a chore. I love that time. But I make sure I always get that done. And then I can focus on the next thing. And the next thing might be, okay, I need to now 7:30, let's tip off my game. I need to talk to my kids from 5:30 to 6. Well, that's me driving, I'll pull off on the side of the road and video chat on the side of the road.
Yeah.
Now whatever you gotta do. You know, it makes it the work-life balance becomes extremely tough when you start getting invested into your basketball careers, no matter what level they are. We all have bills to pay.
Yep.
If you start to have a family and wife and kids, and then you want to add in your basketball, because I'll tell you right now, the wife thinks I'm out having fun with the boys every time I go referee a game.
I bet.
I think it's work. I get paid for it. It's a job to me. It's a passionate job. But she thinks I'm out with the boys. So it's like trying to balance that, making sure that you water your garden before you leave the house.
Have to.
You know?
Yeah, that's a great lesson, great perspective. And, hopefully, folks can kind of take that. Hopefully we inspire a couple of new refs around the country in terms of, the work shortage, or not the work shortage, but labor shortage.
Did I talk about anything positive about officiating? I feel like I never do.
No, I mean, there's a lot of positives of that. I think there's a lot of different, angles of it that I certainly wasn't thinking too hard about in terms of, the refs. They're kind of just like, a constant part of the game that you don't really think about because they're the rules. It really is what they are. They're the rules. They're a human, human depiction of the rule. So that's definitely awesome. Do you have anything else you want to get to tonight?
No, I did earlier. I don't know if I had ever touched on or not. I blacked out. Are we still here?
Yeah. Yeah, we can always circle all the way back to Australia. It's
Oh, I enjoyed it. I was like, God, I've been talking about basketball. I feel like I've been chatting with your ear off. I can get really passionate on the officiating side, and it's a blast. It really is. There is that aura. I'll tell you this story. I don't remember a lot of games that I've worked, but there's that rivalry game on a Friday night, and it's we've got a couple of them out here. We have the Garfield Franklin or Garfield Rainier Beach, which is the Brandon Roy High School versus the Nate Robinson High School in inner city Seattle, or it's Seattle Prep, which is Spencer Hawes and Martell Webster School versus O'Day, which is the Nate Burleson and Doug Wren, Paolo Banchero School. So the two Christian schools, the Catholic and the Prep School. You get those games and you show up to the gym and it's standing room only during the JV game, and getting that feeling of like the band is playing already, you're already sweaty just sitting in the gym. Like that, I've had way more fun working a high school game like that than any of my college games. Like, I love working college basketball, but I don't think I'll ever quit working high school basketball because of that arena and that aura of being in that gym. I've got a great picture that I'll send you. It's one of my favorite photos that I got. It was the year I worked the state tournament, and it was the regional game before the tourney. And it's Paolo Banchero as a freshman versus Kevin Porter Jr. for the Rockets, right? And I'm tossing the ball for that game. And I'm like, okay, this kid's 6'10" he was 6'7" as a freshman. And he was the starting quarterback for the football team that won the state championship.
What?
Allo was, yeah.
What?
This guy is a freak. Like, when you you see him lace it up for Duke, it's like, oh yeah, this kid's a Duke player. The reason why he didn't go to UW. Both of Paolo's parents went to UW, so he was a legacy. He was a shoo-in to go to UW, and he ends up, Coach K called. What do you do?
You dropped the bag.
Yeah. It's a picture of my back, so you can't 100% know it's me other than my red hair, but I'm sitting there tossing it up there, and both Paolo and Kevin Porter Jr. are jumping up, and I'm like, that's a cool photo of, like, in the background, like, just a stacked gym. It's like Rainier Beach High School. So it's like, yeah, there's nothing better.
Hell yeah. I want to see
fun ones.
I don't blame you for ever or never wanting to stop high school basketball, especially where you are. Like,
if you were roughing you know, high school basketball back where I grew up, I think you might have gotten a little bored with it by now. But, you know, you get that sneak peek on, you know, kind of the upcoming talent. You can identify guys like Paolo Banchero from freshman and be like, that's special. I want to go watch more of his games. Hey, I get paid to go watch him now. So that's amazing.
That was one I missed. The year that Michael Porter Jr. came out to Seattle, he went to a school called Nathan Hale, and I never got one of his games. And, you know, he's playing for the Denver Nuggets. So he was the number one player in the nation, came out here, was supposed to go to UW. Yeah, Lorenzo Romar, the coach, gets fired. He goes to Missouri, played all of like 3 minutes in Missouri.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got him the back stuff.
Falls he's down to 17th or 18th pick that year. And he was, I'm telling you, that kid is a top five talent in that draft.
Yeah, he's unreal. The Nuggets got a bunch of late steals with him and Bol Bol, obviously Jokic, MVP already. Like, they're sneaky, the best drafters in the league at the moment.
I never got to work a Michael Porter Jr. game, which I thought would have been a lot of fun. I just didn't, schedule never matched up for it.
Yeah. Oh, man.
One-on-one.
Stud. Yeah. Is there anyone other than Paolo Banchero that you've ref in the last year or so that you think people should kind of get on their radar if they're not already?
I tell you, so there was these twins that were a year younger than me that came out of Rainier Beach. So when I played high school, I graduated in 2002, which is the same year as Nate Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And Nate had two twins that were juniors called Lodrick and Roderick Stewart.
Lodrick
and Roderick.
Amazing.
And one was a lefty, one was a righty. They were both about 6'3", 6'4", and they were two of the nastiest dunkers I've ever seen in my life. Both ended up going to USC originally. One ended up transferring to Kansas and won a championship with Kansas and the Mario Chalmers team. Mm-hmm. One of them has a kid. I don't know which one it is. I think it's Lodrick. Jalen Stewart. He's a sophomore now. I think well, maybe he's going into his junior year now. Stud. Absolute stud. And he's at Garfield being coached by Brandon Roy. Brandon Roy is the head coach at Garfield High School.
Oh, really?
Yep. And they got another kid named Corin Johnson. So that's the backcourt at Garfield. And it's like, this is going to be good.
Nice. It's
going to be really good. You know, there's another one that's I don't know if he's going to play basketball because he's the number two recruit in the nation for football.
Jeez.
His name's JT Tuimoloau.
Wow.
Yeah, good luck spelling it. But yeah. He was an Eastside Catholic kid, and he committed to Ohio State as a defensive end. But he's a 6'8 power forward as well. And he's got the best footwork of any, and I mean, drop step dunk all over your face, like Shaq style. Like he could play, he's a top 25, top 50, probably recruit in the nation for basketball, but he's the number two recruit in football. So he's a good kid.
Hey, I mean, I'm obviously a big basketball fan, not the biggest football fan. I watch it, but if he does the math, he might pick basketball. Just
right.
Even if you're the best football player in the world, you're not getting paid what even like the sixth man on the Rockets is getting paid. Like,
right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just kind of curious to see what he does because he is that good of a basketball player, in my opinion. He's just unbelievable footwork, but he's 6'8", 260. And I mean, I think that's one of the problems that I miss the traditional big man. Mm-hmm. I miss seeing somebody with their back to the basket in the low post. I think the NBA is going to continue to evolve, and we're going to see the post play come back, especially if you find a post player that has the footwork of the Kevin McHales of yesteryear.
Yeah. Haven't really had one since, except like Hakeem.
Hey, started to see the little guards are coming back now. You know what I mean? Like there were a bunch like back in the, you know, the late 90s and stuff like that. So those little guards are coming back, man. Even before that too, like with D. Browns and type of the Celtics and things, Kenny Anderson. So
have you seen Alperen Şengün yet? The rookie out of I believe Turkey.
Was he the draft and stash guy that we got?
No, he's
Oh, Jesus. I want to say Detroit. No. Yeah. He's on the Rockets, right?
Oh, did he just tear it up the other night?
Yeah, he's that guy that you're looking for. Like, he carves out post position and just throws his body around. He's a bit athletic, too. He got a little bit of a jumper developing. He might be your next little back down style guy. And he's got a guy for you, Vucevic, on the Bulls these days. So he's probably the most traditional put his ass under the basket guy right now.
I tell you, my coaching style, I'd want Boban. Boban.
You just roll Boban and Taco out there side by side.
Bobby. We're getting Bobby out there. That's my guy. Seriously. Anybody that's that big and ugly, I want him on my team. Hell yeah.
He's gonna do one thousand for him, man. Yeah. He's funny. And do you still play at all?
You know, I don't. Part of the reason is I used to play in the alumni tournament for the high school group. And I sprained my ankle in the alumni tournament's held on like Thanksgiving or the night before Thanksgiving. Rolled my ankle and was like out for a week and had to turn back games for college. And I'm like, I don't want to jeopardize that money.
Yeah. You know?
So it's like, I miss it. The hardest part is I was never a good shooter. So I never got good enough at shooting to where I'm going to be good at basketball my entire life.
Riding a bike.
I need to be able to block shots. And like, I can't go jumping like that. I'm like, I'm going to tear a knee up.
Yeah.
The game was never played down on the ground. And so it makes it hard for me to go play because it's not my style.
Yeah. You're going to have to go do some Kevin McHale drills.
Exactly. Maybe I can get down to the hook shots and stuff like that. There is something you guys should check out sometime, and it would be a great thing for you guys to talk about on your podcast too, is Hoop Fest. It's the world's largest 3-on-3 tournament.
Okay.
It happens in Spokane, Washington, and it shuts down downtown. Like, they just fill the entire downtown corridor with 3-on-3 courts. And they have an open division, 6-foot and under division. I mean, so many freaking divisions, it's insane. But it's like 5,000 people show up out of nowhere. They have people that fly in from Europe to come and play in the tournament. I mean, it's just, I never played in it growing up, and it was only like 4.5 hours away because usually it was like right around when summer team camps were happening. But then I went and played in it a couple of years ago, and it's like, it's a basketball experience. Wow. Like, it's just one of the guys that you like, need to go check out.
Is it outside?
Yeah, it's all outdoors. Wow. It's just downtown Spokane. It's usually the last weekend of June.
Yeah, you know, I think a few of my old teammates from Calgary went and played in that. Have you ever heard of the last name Beckering?
Beckering?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Henry Beckering was he was at Washington State with Rodney Stuckey.
Eastern Washington.
Eastern.
Yep, that's exactly where I know it.
Yep, and then he ended up transferring back up, and I played with him for 1 year, his last year up in Canada, and it was like, it's so funny because that block charge call you were talking about, he didn't really play a lot of defense for us, but in the NCAA, he was guarding Hassan Adams and all those guys, but for us, he was a scorer. He like one time came in to take a charge for the first time in his, like I ever saw it in my life. And his brother came up and blocked the shot above him. But they got a block on him.
Did they?
And then they ended up shooting free throws, and they were up by 3. We missed 2 game-tying shots, you know, in that final 4 games. So, charge, man. It was like, I don't know why he tried to take a charge. It made no sense. Never. All yeah.
Dude, you're just a score. Stay in your lane.
Simple, bro. Yeah. His brother was the defensive player of the year. Canadian 6'8", you know, could have played NCAA, but like ended up developing late. Like you said, grew to 6'8" and was strong, but was a guard before.
Mm-hmm. That's a good coordination, verticality.
Yeah. And he was like 245, but could like put it behind his back and dunk it at 6'8". Like, he was at a point with like going to summer league. His agent wouldn't let him go because he was like playing so well in Europe. He's like, dude, you make too much money. Like, you're not – I can't have you go to the league and only make it wasn't even the G League. It was a D League. Like, make 12 grand. We're not doing that. You know,
I got to get those commissions, guy. Come on. Back to Spain.
Well, I'll tell you, man, you can make some money over there. I tell you, we that kid, Mike James, who was playing for Brooklyn this year, right? He's a Portland native. And he came and played in the Pro-Am. And I'm like, who the fuck is this kid?
He can ball.
And I'm like, he can ball. Like, this, like, and every NBA player in the States knows he can ball.
Oh, yeah.
And he would get a 10-dayer, but then it'd be like, well, we want to put you in the G League. He'd be like, I can make 1.5 over in Europe. Like, he was getting paid.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, so when he, the right contract came around, which was Phoenix the year before, Phoenix, he had a nice run. And I'm like, I thought he was going to stick in Phoenix.
Me too. I don't know
why. Me too. Yeah. That was funny.
Go YouTube him and at the University of Lamar and watch how Bobby Knight's kid treats him.
Real, no. Pat Knight Jr.
What's that?
Cool with them, or did he like lay into him, or did he just let him ball?
Oh, I think I think Mike was on the microphone for a post game presser, and is it Pat Knight? Right? Yeah, comes in and basically takes over the press conferences and tells him, get the hell out of here, go to the locker room. He's like, you have a fucking heart, and like goes down and goes on a rant.
Yeah, he was.
And I'm like, it was at Lamar University. I'm like, why did he go to Lamar in the first place? I'm like, this kid is a Pac-12 level candidate, in my opinion.
100%. You know, and it's crazy. I don't know if you know the last name Demopolis. Have you heard that last name in
Washington? Yeah.
Yeah, I worked with James when I was coaching a little bit. And he's like a big time Seattle. Like, he knows everybody. And his pops, too, was at Temple with. With all that, it was like hearing about Seattle hoops like the last 6 months. I was like, dang, I didn't even know about all this stuff. Like, he gave me a lot of insight on it.
I think we're hitting a little bit of a lull this year. Like, the crossover is insane right now. I mean, you got Jamal and Isaiah playing and Nate playing, but like, all of our young guys that just finished college are all there. Like, Malachi Flynn, who was at Wazoo and then went to San Diego State. Who he signed with, both the McDaniels brothers. Wow. You got Spencer, you got Matisse showing up now after the Olympics. Yep. You got DeJounte Murray, Kevin Porter Jr. It's ridiculous amount of NBA guys that are like in the Seattle area. And I'm just like, I tuned in and watched one of the games on a live stream. And I'm like, holy cow. Like, the guys I run play when I was coaching, I'm like, they get their asses kicked. Too much talent.
You might be able to slap together a halfway decent NBA team with that group. That's wild. Oh, yeah. They whoop some summer league right now, that's for sure.
Malachi's one of my, I really like the way that kid plays. He's a Tacoma native kid and just got a really good head on his shoulders. I hope he sticks somewhere in the league. He can run a team. Like, the way he just manages the basketball court, like, he kind of commands attention.
Yep.
Nothing splashy, nothing stands out. He doesn't do anything exceptional, but he's a floor general. If someone lets him do that in the league, he can turn, you know, Chris Paul-like numbers, I think.
Pritchard.
Yeah, he's a Raptor right now.
Is that where he's at?
Yeah, he got all NBA G League second team this year. And, you know, he's probably a couple of positions lost behind Fred VanVleet. But, that, you know, just learning behind Kyle Lowry last year and having Fred VanVleet ahead of him as a mentor ain't bad.
Conley's gone now, right?
Conley?
Yeah, then they sent him to Orlando. Not Conley, Lowry.
Yeah, Lowry. Lowry went to Miami. He signed with Miami for cheaper. He's going to retire. I have his number retired stuff there. He'll probably do the one day, like, retire as a Raptor contract at the end, but he's tracing that one more ring with Miami this year. But the East is stacked, so we'll see.
Ed Rush was at a training camp out here, and there was another referee from his days in the 80s and 70s named Terry Durham. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somehow ended up at the bar sitting next to them on one of the nights of the camp. And Ed was giving me some advice, and I said, Ed, I want to ask you something. You know, I grew up in Seattle. Your name got dragged through the mud back in 93. And he's like, oh yeah, yeah, the Suns game here. It was game 7, Suns versus Sonics to go to the finals, Western Conference Finals. 74 foul calls or something. Charles Barkley shoots like 35 free throws. Ed Rush is the crew chief on it. And I said, did you guys have a good game or not? It's like, oh, fuck. Sean and Charles fucked that game up long before we ever did. And, yeah. I mean, it was just one of the funniest stories. And I said, well, can you tell me something about Larry Bird? Like, And he's like, Terry Durham jumps in. He's like, Larry Bird should have a Hall of Fame bust in his office for Ed Rush, the way Ed Rush called fouls for Larry Bird. Just the two of them, I got them drunk, and they were just going off about how, you know, Ed Rush was Larry Bird's favorite official. And, you know, it was awesome story time. But you know, back then, you didn't have 13 angles during a game.
Yeah.
You had to trust the official, and the official had to be able to bullshit his way through everything.
Yeah, not a lot for instant replays on the Jumbotron, even really. And even if it was like 10p, not 1080p.
And you had one angle if you were lucky, right?
Yeah.
Now you have 15, 16. I mean, I've got 5 angles at a Division II college game. Mm-hmm. So when I go to the monitor, I can look at it from 5 different angles. I mean, those guys are looking at 15 in HD and zooming in. You don't have the ability to be as wrong as they used to be.
Yeah, and like that phantom cam, like you saw it in the playoffs this year with like a play that's like, and like it was a big discussion of the commentators. I think it was Van Gundy and Mark Jackson were talking about it. A play that's super common, happens, you know, in pickup and high school and every level, and it's always kind of called the same way. But if you did slow it down to that fraction of a second, it was the play with Pat Beverly on the sideline there, where it went out of bounds and they called it off. I think it was Devin Booker, right? And because, yeah, technically it was off the very last fingertip kind of thing, which it almost always is because the, you know, the defender swiping up, the offender's dribbling. So sometimes the offender, you know, but it's never called that way. What's your opinion or take on that? And like, what do they do with that kind of phantom, the phantom cam doing it 4,000 frames per second or whatever the hell it is?
I wish they would let officials decide when we need to go to the monitor.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Instead of letting players be able to challenge it. I mean, right is right, and the right call is last touched, you know, by the dribbler.
Mm-hmm.
But for years and my entire life, and I still will call that out of bounds on the defender. He's the one that swiped in there and caused the ball to go out of bounds.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that's kind of the gist of it.
That's what Van Gundy was saying too on the broadcast. It's like kind of an intent kind of rule.
Yeah.
But
and I don't know how you can possibly change the verbiage in the rule book. And I mean, the rule book gets changed every year. Like there's always some little tweak and we change something, you know, whether it's adding the restricted arc, it's changing the shot clock, it's changing how a foul is interpreted. The big one this year for the NBA and for college is going to be, you know, jumping into players on jump shots. Right, we're not going to be rewarding those guys for free throws,
yep.
Which I love that. I'm so tired of the Kevin Durant swipe through play. Like, we got to the point where we stopped trusting officials to officiate the game and manage it, where they just want officials to call black and white, and that's not good for the game either. Right? If it went black and white all the time, we wouldn't have games the way we should. Like, we want that flow. We want to manage the game. It's an art. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something that I kind of hope we get back to. We have to lose some camera angles to do it.
Yeah, you gotta go backwards in time technology a little bit.
I mean, think about it. The NFL did it for a few years. You know, we had instant replay in the NFL in the late 80s and early 90s, and then they got rid of instant replay. And then the referees screwed up a few games, and then they had to bring in some replay back. And now we've screwed it up again and again.
Yeah. And they still don't know what a catch is, yeah. 10 years later, since, like, Calvin Johnson's whole mishap in the end zone, there was, yeah.
That's the same thing with this out-of-bounds stuff. It's like, God, Now, if the defender knocks it off the guy's foot, okay, yeah, you know, he knocks it off the other guy's leg, great. But knock it out, and his pinky's the thing that's the last thing to touch it. It's like, you know.
Yeah, it's tough.
It's tough.
It's tough too, because like I think that was the last 2 minutes kind of thing too, where they just freaking go over the top of the reviews. Where if that happens in the first quarter, they're not even second thought. That's just, you know, that's still Phoenix's ball, and it's just play on. Like, and no one's even realizing it.
Yeah, and no referee's ever going to get that play by the
in live. Our eyeballs literally are not fast enough.
Be like, that guy caused it to go out of bounds. It's gonna go that way. I couldn't tell it was still
Well, that's a, I feel like that's a good one to wrap up on. Can I leave the Ed Rush talk at the bar in?
Yeah. Yeah, you can leave that part.
Okay. I'll cut the one that you mentioned before the story kind of thing. Yeah. And we'll probably just lead right into the Ed Rush thing from wherever it was before that. But
that should be fine.
Nice. Is there
I think Ed Rush is gonna be listening to the podcast. He's kind of he doesn't do basketball at all. He's a football coach.
Really? That's fun.
He still runs referee training stuff, but he does not like, he's anti-media, anti like talking basketball really. And he's been a like assistant football coach in Pennsylvania for years.
That's funny. That's a certain type of guy for sure. A Pennsylvania football coach. Do you have any sort of like social media or any camps or stuff that you want to plug coming up or anything?
You know, the biggest thing that I can say to anybody who's listening is to go apply to your local high school, you know, referee association. They're not hard to find, and they are in desperate need of good people that want to contribute to the game of basketball.
Nice.
So you'll get a kick out of it. You'll build some relationships. You will learn a lot. And if you do decide to get into refereeing basketball and officiating high school sports, be humble. Know how badly you have treated your own officials over the last 20, 30, 40 years of your life, and realize how hard it actually is. Because someone's going to come and yell at you while you're doing the job. Just remember how that feeling is. So the next time when you go watch, you won't be yelling at an official.
So oh, that's good.
I guess that's the one thing that I'd love to plug. I hope everyone tries it out at least once.
No, that'd be awesome. Even if we get one ref out of this, that'd be cool. But yeah, we appreciate you coming on and you know, sharing these stories and everything. You're a basketball professional from several angles, so it's pretty cool.
The game has been very good to me, and I will always give back to it. So I appreciate you guys doing what you do, and I look forward to listening to a lot more of your guys' stuff and future guests.